Biddy turned his head away and tried to purify his thoughts. But the direction he turned showed him a man making a child do something unspeakable. He began to feel a little ill and walked much closer to Sir Johnny's heels. These creatures were worse than animals, far worse. Biddy followed Sir Johnny into the lean-to. How the place stank. There was somebody sitting on a tree trunk they had built the lean-to over. The man was awfully fat and was yellowish with the yellow that Dr. McKendrick said was malaria. The folds of the man's body made deep seams of dirt. He had a funny cap on that must be made out of leather. It had a peak in front. There was something set on it. A woman's brooch? Some kind of stone? A diamond? The creature they had captured, Arf, was standing in front of the fat man. With a fist beat on his chest, Arf was making a report. What was he calling the fat man? General Smith? Wasn't Smith a cyclo-common name? Wasn't Smith the common English name? Terrible hard to tell with that oatmeal accent. The general was chewing on a haunch of something and didn't seem much impressed. Finally, the general spoke.
Did you get your supplies? The sulfur.
Well, no,
Arf said and tried to tell it all again.
Did you bring back your stiffs?
The general said.
Stiffs? Stiffs? Oh, bodies.
This Captunk Arf seemed to get a bit scared and back up. The general hurled the haunch straight at him and hit him in the face with it.
How'd you expect to eat, then?
Screamed the general.
Eat? Stiffs? Bodies? Eat? Their own dead?
Then Biddy looked down at the thrown haunch that had ricocheted toward him.
It was a human arm.
Hurriedly, Biddy got out of there and got back of the lean-to and was very sick at his stomach. But Sir Johnny found him in a moment and put an arm around his shoulders and wiped his mouth with a bandana. He tried to get a Russian to take Biddy back to the plane, but Biddy wouldn't go. The place of a squire was with his knight, and Johnny might need his blast rifle among these horrible creatures. So they let him continue to follow. Sir Johnny looked into the lean-to in the edge of the trees and seemed very interested, and Biddy looked and saw a very old, very battered instruction machine like the pilots used to learn cyclo, and this seemed to mean something to Sir Johnny. Who were they looking for now? The rain was coming down, and these people were racing around, and the blast rifle was very heavy and getting heavier. Oh, the coordinators. They found them in another lean-to, a pair of young Scots. Wasn't one of them a McCandless from Inverness? Yes, he thought he recognized him. They sat there, soaking wet, even under cover, their bonnets like mops. They looked pretty white of face. Sir Johnny was trying to find out how they got here, and they were pointing to a pile of cable dropped by a plane. So Sir Johnny told them they'd better leave with them, and they were saying no. It was a council order to bring these people back to the compound in America, and even though the transports were overdue, they had supposed it was trouble for the council to be finding enough pilots for the lift. After a lot of argument about their duty on their side and their safety on Sir Johnny's side, they were persuaded to at least come to the plane where they could be given a food package and maybe some weapons. So they all pushed their way through this mob of people back to where the Russians held a defense perimeter and got into the plane. Sir Robert was there. He sat the two Scott coordinators down in one of the big cyclo bucket seats.
Was there the third one of you? Sir Robert wanted to know.
Well, yes, said McCandless. There was Allison, but a couple of days ago he fell in a river and some scaly beast got him.
Did you see this? Said Sir Robert.
Well, no, they hadn't seen it. The general had told them, and there were plenty of rivers and lots of scaly beasts. Sir Johnny was saying something now.
Did Allison talk cyclo?
He was in pilot training, said McCandless. The Federation needs its own pilots sometimes. I suppose he did.
Yes, he did, said the other Scot. He could talk some cyclo. They pulled him out of the class to come here. The order to lift these people out came very suddenly from the council, and we were short.
Sir Robert said,
Do you recall hearing him talk cyclo to these ruffians around here?
They thought for a while. The rain was drumming on the marine attack plane roof, and it was awfully hot.
"Aye,"
said McCandless, finally.
"I heard him talking to one of the officers that was finding it remarkable he talked Cyclo. They chatted away in it quite a while. I don't speak."
"That's all we wanted to know," Sir Robert was saying. He looked up at Sir Johnny meaningfully. "Interrogation? They wanted him for interrogation?" And Sir Johnny was nodding. Then Sir Robert pulled out something Biddy didn't know he had, a tam-o'-shanter with blood on it. He handed it to the two coordinators. They found some thread initials in it. Yes, it was Allison's. Where'd Sir Robert get it? Sir Robert blasted them very proper. He told them, and Biddy was shocked to learn that the Brigantes had sold Allison to the Cyclos. And the Cyclos must have wanted him for interrogation, and God help Allison now.
Sold Allison?
A human being? To the monsters? Neither Biddy nor the coordinators could get their wits around that. There was a dreadful row then. Sir Robert ordered the two coordinators to come along with them. The coordinator said this was their duty, to lift these people out. It was a council order. And Sir Robert thundered at them that he was the war chief of Scotland, and he damned well wasn't going to leave them here. The two coordinators tried to leave, and Sir Johnny and Sir Robert, using the cargo lashings Biddy hastily found, simply tied them up. They put them on top of the supplies at the rear of the plane. They withdrew their defense perimeter and took off, and Biddy was not surprised to hear one of the pilots ask permission to strafe these creatures from the air. Sir Robert said no. If they tried that, the creatures would just run under the trees. They weren't equipped to handle them right now, and they had other things to do. But if they'd done what they appeared to have done, they'd have a bloody feud on their filthy hands. Everybody was pretty upset about Allison. When they had taken off and were flying back to the compound, Biddy got to pondering those people down there. He leaned over to Sir Johnny and said,
"Sir Johnny, how in all this rain can they be so dirty?"
2. The big marine attack plane landed in the night near the branch mine. It was still deserted. The rain still came down. But there were quarreling sounds of animals over where the skirmish had been fought. The snarls and spits of angry leopards, the shattering barks of some other beast, the eerie cackling laughter of yet another predator. They were fighting over the bodies of the dead. The flatbed with the flying platform and blast mortar was where it had been prepared, just inside the hangar door. There was no sign that the other flatbed had returned in retreat. It must still be following the convoy. Johnny looked through the deserted compound again. The lights were still on. The distant mine pumps still pounded away. Unless disturbed by some outside force, all such machinery would probably continue to run for decades. The planetary traffic printer was still sitting there spewing out paper that recorded current traffic. Johnny glanced through it.
"McIver, can you please bring extra fuel to Moscow?"
"This is the traffic controller at Johannesburg. Are there any planes en route this way? If not, I can close Dune for the night." "Isaac, please come in, Isaac. Listen, Isaac, were there any serviceable ore freighters left in the Grozny mine site? And can they be converted for passengers? Please let me know by morning. We're a wee bit shy of carriers right now. Lundy, we're cancelling you on the Tibet run. We need you and your co-pilot back here to help with an airlift. Please acknowledge, laddie."
Most of it in the pilot jargon of Cyclo. It struck Johnny that this stream of messages would give an attacker a pretty good idea of what areas were actively operating. It was almost a catalog of targets for Mark 32s. If the convoy got through and these Cyclos mounted an overall attack, they could take back the planet. He wondered whether he shouldn't put out a general call on this set and order a 72-hour radio silence. But no, the damage was done. These same messages were probably reeling out of the Lake Victoria mine site printer, too. And any transmission he made here might be picked up by the convoy, alerting it. Well, he would just have to succeed with the convoy, that was all. He walked back through the empty, echoing levels. The Cyclos, he noticed, had mainly stripped the place of armament. They were leaving no blast guns or portable weapons behind to fall into Brigante hands. Lucky they'd overlooked the mortars in their haste. The flatbed was out of the hangar now, waiting in the dark yard. Johnny shut the doors of the compound, no use letting in the leopards and elephants and snakes. He went back to the big plane and did a rapid review of the actions that were about to occur. He told them to fly in very low indeed, hugging ground, from way over to the east and come in behind the ambush point. He didn't want that plane on convoy tank screens. Then deploy along this ridge, this one here that flanked the road, and when the convoy was well into the ravine, give them a flanking fire. What if they turned around and started back? Well, he'd be there with a mortar on the flying platform to keep them from retreating. What? An incredulous Robert the Fox was saying. One mortar against tanks? That's impossible. The convoy would be able to get back into the forest, and they'd never get them out. Oh, you want this plane to take off and help block that? Well, that's all right. It is a battle plane. Just try to roll the tanks and trucks over without exploding them, said Johnny. Use no radiation bullets, just blast gun force. Keep your weapons on broad blast, no flame, and stun. We don't want to kill them. As soon as they're all strung out along this ravine, block the road from the ambush. I'll block it from the rear. The rest of you flank it from the ridge. This battle plane is to help if they get loose and head back toward the forest. Right?
Right.
A coordinator tried unsuccessfully to make up for the absence of the Russian coordinator, who was now with Ivan, and then said,
I'll make sure the Russian coordinator explains it when we get to the others. Oh, I've got it straight. I can tell them then.
Remember, said Johnny, there's a slim possibility that Allison is in that convoy, so keep your eye out for him, and if he gets away in the fight, don't shoot him.
Right.
And they'd get it explained to these Russians here when they caught up with Ivan.
Smooth, said Robert the Fox. Oh, so very smooth. The bulk of our force can't be briefed because the translator is elsewhere. What stupendous planning and coordination. I wish us luck. We will need it.
Johnny said, but we've got the cyclos outnumbered.
What? Exclaimed Robert the Fox. There's more than 100 of them, and only 50 or so of us.
That's what I mean, said Johnny. We've got them outnumbered 1/2 to 1. They got it, and some Russians more advanced in English than the rest explained the joke to the other Russians. They all laughed. The rain had been getting them down. They felt better. Johnny was getting down to the flatbed, where a Scot and 4 Russians, one of them a driver, waited, when a scurry in the plane drew his attention. It was Bitty McLeod, all set to go with him, draped around with equipment. This was something Johnny did not want. The coming battle was nothing to drag the boy into. But there was a problem, the boy's pride. Johnny thought fast. This was almost harder to solve than the tactics. Biddy's world was filled with the romances of 2,000 years ago, when knighthood was in flower, with flame-breathing dragons and pure knights and rescued fair damsels. Nothing wrong with that. He was a sweet little boy, and his greatest ambition was to grow up and become a man like Dunnell Dean or himself. Nothing wrong with that either. But his dreams risked bruising against the brutal realities of this world in which they fought, a world with its own brand of dragons. He would never live to become like Prince Dunnell Dean or Sir Johnny if he were not protected. But there was his pride, and it was showing now when he saw Johnny's paws, saw the search for an excuse to say no in Johnny's ice-blue eyes. Hurriedly, Johnny grabbed a mine radio from a seat and thrust it into the boy's hands. Johnny tapped the one in his own belt. He leaned very close to Biddy's ear and whispered, I need a reliable contact on this plane who can tell me, after the battle is joined, if anything is going wrong. Don't use it until the first shot is fired. But if there's anything amiss after that, you tell me fast. He put a finger to his lips. Biddy was instantly bright, if a trifle conspiratorial. He nodded.
Oh, yes, Sir Johnny.
And he faded back into the plane. Johnny hobbled down the squishy road to the flatbed. It was sitting there, lights stabbing through the sheets of rain. He checked his crew, got in, and nodded to the driver. The flatbed, with its flying mine platform and mortar, roared, drowning out the snarling fight over in the woods. They were off in a truck to do combat with tanks.